Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So the title I have is Suffering in the Communion of Saints. I want to start off just to acknowledge this is a difficult topic, and the way philosophers approach the topic of thinking about why would God, a perfectly good, perfectly powerful, loving being, create creatures in an environment where we experience so much intense suffering. There's a theoretical question there, and that's the question philosophers are interested in, but for most people it's an intensely personal, visceral kind of subject when people are undergoing intense suffering. So I just want to acknowledge that what we're doing, it's not meant to address. This would be the worst kind of, the kind of things that we'll be talking about today would be the worst thing to say to someone, or be the worst. It would be profoundly unhelpful to get engage in a theoretical inquiry about, well, you know, maybe we could think about suffering like this kind of thing. That's a kind of pastoral problem of suffering, right? You're best off talking to your priest, a good therapist, your parent, a good friend, somebody like that, not a philosopher. So what good is a philosopher? Well, philosopher can be useful because suffering, what philosophers call the problem of evil, is the chief reason that people give for disbelieving in God's existence, right? And people implicitly take it to be a kind of evidence, even overwhelming evidence against the existence of God, right? But to assess that claim, you have to kind of think in theoretical terms like you would is some kind of experimental result, powerful evidence against some theory, right? And so it takes on this kind of abstract theoretical dimension to it. Right? It's worth thinking about that when you're not going through intense suffering, because it can kind of be there in the background for that period of life when you do, and if you haven't, you will, if you live long enough. So maybe indirectly it could even be helpful for that as well. But, you know, if this sounds kind of coldly clinical in the way I'm talking about it, I am a human being. This isn't the way I would talk about with somebody who's going through suffering. I just want to say that because sometimes philosophers are accused of talking about this topic in kind of insensitive ways. It has a purpose, right? It's just not a purpose of comforting someone in the context of suffering. And that may be true of some of you in this room, right? Could well be true given how many people are in this room. All right, so it's such a big topic. There are so many facets to the question of why, you know, suffering. Philosophers break it down into several different ways of thinking about the topic. We can't talk about all of those, right? So we're going to kind of isolate a certain way of thinking about it. I'm going to look at one strand, which I take to actually be the most difficult, the most challenging strand. But there are other ways of thinking about this problem. So sometimes philosophers talk about the logical problem of evil, because sometimes people say the very existence of any kind of badness in the world is somehow, it kind of contradicts the idea that God is all-powerful, nothing can thwart his will, and he's omnibenevolent, his purposes are wholly good, and indeed he is a God of love who loves his creatures. Well, that should mean there's zero suffering, right? Because, you know, parents sometimes can't keep their kids from suffering, right? Even if they're very loving parents, because they're not omnipotent. There are forces at play that parents are powerless in the face of. But if God's omnipotent, how can there be any suffering at all? I'm not going to talk about that. Philosophers have said a lot about that very abstract way of framing the question. A second way is evidential. Even if you think, okay, the logical problem can be addressed, the evidential problem says, well, look, if you just look at the sheer amount and the intensity, the magnitude, the seemingly random distribution of who suffers and who suffers the most intensely and why, or certain really horrific kinds of evil, does this count as kind of evidence against the existence of God? Maybe there's evidence pointing in the other direction, but is this like a big, you know, massive thumb on the scale going in the negative direction, so-called evidential problem of view. I'm not going to talk about that tonight. There are special case problems of evil, young children, right? Because a lot of the things I'll talk about tonight don't really have application to young children. A lot of the ways of addressing the problem of evil, right? What about people that have severe cognitive deficits, either congenitally, right, or because of some traumatic injury, right, who are then incapable, seemingly, of forming certain kinds of relationships or even bonding with God? What about the problem of animal suffering, right? These are all very legitimate questions. Like I say, this is a big, big topic. We're not going to talk about those. Instead, we're just going to talk about this final question. What is most bothersome under this heading is when people suffer horrifically, either at a large scale, things like the Holocaust, right, the Soviet gulags, things like that, horrible, you know, inhumanity towards large scales of human beings that dehumanize them, or just individuals that suffer horrifically, right? And we don't need to, you can imagine in your own mind various kinds of instances that fall under this. When people undergo them, cause them to question whether their life has any positive meaning at all. That's often a response people have when they suffer this kind of trauma. So how could these kinds of evils, that's the question I want to think about tonight, how could they serve any good purposes that God might have in permitting them? And God does permit them if God exists, because God is the creator of all things and he's omnipotent. So nothing happens that he doesn't at least permit to happen. Okay, so we're seeking a plausible answer to a kind of how possibly could there be a good purpose, right? Question. And Christian theology says some things that address that, but I'll suggest, I don't have time to talk about this in detail, I don't think Christian theology gives us an answer to this question, okay? You know, if you think about a kind of dialogue, you know, so someone might say, well, look, according to Christian revelation, the earliest human beings disobeyed God. As the result of that was kind of catastrophic in many ways, and sin and suffering entered the world as a result of that. But, you know, God didn't just leave it at that. He sent, you know, God the Son came to dwell among us and to bring about the means of our transformation and ultimate redemption. But someone might say, okay, but why did God create a world where the fall and suffering were possible to begin with? And maybe the answer is, well, there's a value. God gifted us with freedom, the ability to freely enter into a love relationship. That's plausibly part of Christian theology. Certainly Catholic theology puts a lot of emphasis on that. But then someone might say, okay, but why did God not at least restrain the amount of damage that we could do, that we're capable of doing to other people? So I'm a parent of now 3 grown children. When, you know, every parent knows when you have multiple children, sometimes kids, they squabble, they fight. Sometimes you choose to pull back and see if they can kind of work it out, okay? You know, but at the point where, you know, maybe my son reaches and picks up a baseball bat and goes towards his sister with it, okay, I'm going to intervene. I'm going to, like, no more free will for you. I'm not going to let you do that to your sister, right? So I might give, you know, a certain degree of freedom, but I'm not going to give him the freedom to do permanent physical damage to his little sister because he's frustrated or something like that, right? And so then the worry is, well, it's as if God did that. He just lets human beings run amok with evil desires and inflict horrible things upon other creatures. Well, okay, there's this back and forth that's going to go on. At some point in this kind of dialectic, you're going to enter the realm of speculative proposals. You're going to go beyond what Christian theology directly says and kind of says, well, maybe we can think about it this way. But if it's an authentically Christian proposal, however speculative, then it has to at least be consistent with the basic Christian narrative, right? So that's what I'm after, a kind of, you know, consistent extension of, rather than another story, but an extension of what Christianity does seem to say about God and God's purposes vis-a-vis suffering in the world. Another point I want to clarify, though, because people often ask this, they'll say, oh, so are you, if you're offering certain speculative proposals, are you claiming to know the mind of God? Well, you know, what reasons God has that he hasn't told us about, you know, but you just figure them out using reason? No, at least one shouldn't. That would be very presumptuous, right? And philosophers can be arrogant sometimes, but I'm not that arrogant, right? The right way to think about it is to say, well, what we're trying to do is just ask ourselves, can we get a glimmer of how it might make sense that God would permit this, even if we don't know the actual reasons, right, in detail for every kind of suffering that we observe? If we have some reason to think there are some plausible ideas that he might be up to, right, then that kind of undercuts the force of evil and suffering as evidence against the existence of God. Right? If we could see how it might go, even if we don't know the actual reasons. So that's what we're after. All right, so what are these starting points in Christian theology? Well, St. Thomas says, echoing the Bible and the subsequent Christian tradition, he says, God is love. That's straight out of the Bible. And God created us for a kind of intense union with him. God desires every creature, every human creature that has ever lived, God's desire is that that creature enter into an intense, eternal union with him. And there's no higher good for us, right? Christian theology teaches us that if we could fully realize that union, there's nothing that could have greater value than to be in that kind of relationship to God, because God is the good itself. God is perfect goodness. To be united to perfect goodness, right? There's no higher bliss possible for any creature. So that seems to indicate that suffering, if it's true that he's created us for union, he wants that, suffering, even horrendous suffering, must be intended by God somehow to foster this ultimate goal, right? God wouldn't permit it if God did not intend that somehow it can be potentially be used to serve this goal. So this has some now implications or seeming constraints on a plausible Christian solution or at least mitigation of the problem. The first is that mere, what you might say, overbalance of the suffering in a finite, so sometimes people say, well, look, even worst-case scenarios of people who have prolonged, decades-long, horrendous suffering, that's finite. It's really bad, but it's finite because we only live on Earth for a finite period of time. But if such a person goes on to have an eternal, blissful experience in heaven, well, you know, infinity swamps any finite value, right? So it's as if it's as nothing in the scales in comparison. So eternity overbalances, massively overbalances even the worst suffering on earth. Is that good enough? No, because a loving God would not choose to have us endure a massive amount of suffering for no purpose whatsoever. He wouldn't just say, well, okay, so all right, that was terrible. All right, but never mind. Don't worry about that, because for the rest, you know, for eternity, you're no longer going to experience that, right? That would be gratuitous to do that. Why do that? So it's not enough just to say we potentially are going to experience an unending, blissful life. Furthermore, it doesn't seem consistent with God's loving you and me as individuals that he permits him to suffer horrifically so that I can benefit, right? He uses him as a mere means to my good. That seems inconsistent with God's loving him, right? Now, he may intend his suffering
also to benefit me, right? Because we're interconnected, and the good for the good and the bad for each of us affects the good and the bad for others. But it can't be merely instrumental, right? It has to be then that if he suffers horrendously, it has the potential that he can, in some sense, benefit from that suffering in the long run. It seems like then the worst forms of human suffering must be capable of being defeated. I'm using this as a kind of technical term, right? That is, rendered, you might say, positively meaningful somehow within the fullness of our lives. Instances of horrendous suffering are terrible in themselves. We're not saying, it turns out they weren't bad after all. No, they are bad. They're intrinsically really bad, right? But the thought is, evil could be defeated if somehow in a larger lifespan, it could take on some kind of positive significance. We sometimes see this in individual human lives, people who undergo trauma, right? A therapist might help that individual to revisit what happened in a traumatic episode and see how that shaped them in certain ways that they actually value about themselves as a survivor of that trauma, right? So then in some weird way, they say, it was horrible what happened to me, but I, in some sense, don't wish it away having gotten to a point of healing because I now value who I am as a result of having undergone that terrible suffering. Or sometimes people use aesthetic analogies here, right? So if any of you are fans of kind of sophisticated forms of music, you might know that sometimes you can isolate little sounds in a musical symphony that are actually, if you just heard that one note for a second or two and nothing else, you didn't hear it in context, you'd be like, that sounds harsh, like a blaring trumpet, right? But it's written in the music to be a blaring trumpet sound, right? Harsh. So it's not beautiful. It's kind of ugly, actually, right? But if that that ugly note occurs right before the most kind of achingly beautiful part of the symphony, it actually enhances your appreciation of what comes after it, right? The disconnect between the two, the distance between it. So in some sense, the ugly note gets defeated in the context of the whole symphony, right? So something like that, that's just an aesthetic value, right? And we're not saying, God's looking at our lives and saying there's some kind of, artistic beauty to the fact that you're suffering horribly. No, I'm not saying that. That was just an analogy, right? Aesthetic value is one thing. Moral value is a different sort of thing. So the thought is, morally speaking, this horrible event or episode or protracted experience, or maybe even a communal horrible protracted experience, within a wider frame can take on a kind of, it can get defeated in the context of a larger life. Well, it's one thing to suggest that, but it's another to say, how do you make that at all plausible when you think about some of the most horrific kinds of suffering that people have undergone? Well, I'm going to look at two proposals by two philosophers. One, Eleanor Stump on the left, probably the greatest living philosophical interpreter of the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas, so it's fitting for a Thomistic Institute talk to talk about some of Eleanor's ideas. And then Marilyn Adams, who died just a few years ago, who was an Episcopalian priest. She had ideas about thinking about both of them focusing on really intense suffering that individuals undergo and what to think about them within the context of Christian theology. I think it's clear that neither of their proposals provides a complete solution to the problem. Hate to disappoint you. In about 20 minutes, I'm not going to solve this problem. I don't think even after having carefully studied what they did, I don't think they do either. But I do think they take us some ways toward a solution, right? I think it's a mistake, actually, to look for a silver bullet, as we used to say back in the days of the Lone Ranger, and Tonto television show from prehistory, right? That is a single type of way of thinking about the problem that covers all cases, because there's so many different forms of suffering. that people undergo, and people respond very differently to the kinds of suffering they undergo, right? So they're kind of, think of them as kind of chipping away at the problem, kind of shedding light, potential light on what God could be up to with certain kinds of suffering. After we look at what they have to say, I'm going to suggest a further theme from Catholic theology that I think maybe can take us a little bit further towards a solution. All right. So Eleanor's book, Wandering in Darkness, came out in 2011. It's a big, fat book. I'm going to warn you, it's like 550 pages or something like this, kind of like a life's work. And it's a systematic exploration of St. Thomas Aquinas's way of thinking about evil in the world. It's a wonderful book, and it's subtitled Narrative and the Problem of Suffering. And at the heart of the book, she has these chapters that are very lengthy chapters where she's looking at certain biblical narratives and trying to draw out the themes in the life of Abraham and Job and Samson and Mary of Bethany, these four characters where she's trying to illustrate the ideas she has. I think it's a wonderful book. If you have the heart for, I mean, if you have the time and the stomach for it, it's beautifully written. She draws on all kinds of sources. There's lots of literary stuff going on in the book, and it's a very rich book. It's like a meditation as well as a philosophical treatise. All right, so we'll get to that slide. All right, sorry for the small font, but I'm just isolating 11 points that she makes, and it's good to kind of quickly see them all together. Like I said, it's a complex book, but I think you'll be able to see easily enough what she's up to. So she says, look, God is love. That's Christian theology. God is indeed a trinity of divine persons united in love, right? In mutual love. God created us to share in that love. And in loving God, to properly love one another. That's the whole purpose of creation. Of the creation of human beings, according to Christian theology. Okay, so she's just announcing starting points. These are constraints that in some ways raise the bar, make it more challenging to see what a solution might look like. And then she gives an analysis of what love is at its heart, and she says it's love is constituted by two things. If you love someone, you want the good for them, and you want to be united with them. Now, there are different kinds of love relationship. What the desire for being united with amounts to in a spousal love relationship is one thing. In a parental child love relation, that's another kind of thing. In a love relation among just two friends, right? There's still a kind of wanting to be with that person, you know, a commonality of mind, a kind of drawing closer to one another as you get to know that person, right? Where you kind of look at the world in very similar ways. You're becoming united with that person, okay? And then finally, with God, right? And so Stump suggests, following St. Thomas, that even to properly love another human being, ultimately we need to be in a love relationship with God. It's only when we are united with God that we can properly see other human beings as fellow image bearers of God, right? And we love them through our love of God. Sadly, the fall, right? In some way, right, we rebel against God. When we begin to will things other than what God wills for us, we become divided against ourselves. And we suffer what she calls a kind of willed loneliness. Right? It's a kind of rift. Fundamentally, sin is a rift in that union with God. It's often a rift in union with other human beings, right? So how do we recover that? That requires being aware of what we're doing when we're sinning, how we're damaging relationships, and becoming integrated again, whole people, and being transformed within. All right, that's a very short sentence that stands for a whole lot of theology, right? I'm just kind of gesturing at an idea that hopefully is somewhat familiar to you. You can kind of fill in the gaps there. St. Thomas says God wants all human beings to be saved, but not all human beings are saved, right, in his view. How is that possible if God is omnipotent? Well, love requires freedom. God gifts us with freedom, and this entails risk. God actually makes himself, in a way, vulnerable in creation, in giving us freedom, because we might freely and persistently choose to reject union with God, right? And, you know, if that happens, you know, that there's the absence of that relationship that God willed for us. So a little bit of philosophical lingo that's common in Christian theology, you could talk about God's antecedent and consequent will. Okay, that's just fancy Latin-derived kind of terms, right? But all it means is what God might will if it were just up to God alone, if he hadn't given us freedom. Well, then he would desire our flourishing and our being in union with him, right, directly, and it would be very simple and very straightforward. But what does God will given what we will, which is often not that union, right? Well, then God might will certain things in our lives, right, as a way to try to draw us back into that union with him. So he might will suffering, might be part of his actual will, his consequent will, that we suffer in certain ways, even though he doesn't intrinsically desire that we suffer, but he might will it as a means, as a vehicle to bringing us back to union with him, okay? So suffering is, according to Aquinas, consequently willed by God as an effective means to get us to open ourselves more deeply to God, to receive the grace that we need for transformation. But it doesn't guarantee this good outcome, because you can become simply embittered through suffering. You can become hateful as a result of suffering that you experience, right? But suffering has the potential to lead to becoming vulnerable and open to God and receiving the grace that he wants to provide us. And when you're more open to God, you open up to other people, and so you become more capable of loving them properly as well. All right, so then she picks out four biblical narratives that you see here. Mary of Bethany was the one, you know, Mary and Martha, and then Mary, the sister of Lazarus, who dies after Jesus delays coming back when he hears word that Lazarus is in a bad way, and she's devastated because by the time Jesus arrives on the scene, Lazarus is dead, her beloved brother, right? So she talks about that whole narrative as well. And she suggests the reason she chooses these four narratives, she says in some sense it represents the panoply of kinds of human suffering. So she says with Job, we get physical pain and mental agony in an innocent victim. That's what the story of Job is about. I won't rehearse the details, but that's basically what's happening. He's just hit with horrific, you know, his life's going great, and then all of a sudden he's slammed upside the head and he suffers horribly for no reason, right? Nothing he did that warranted that. Samson destroys himself. There's the kind of insidious evil that comes about when somebody just wills their own destruction in a complicated kind of way as a result of sin. Abraham, when he's asked to sacrifice his only son, Isaac, the son of the promise, right? He's, you know, devastated by that because he's his beloved son, Isaac, and what the suffering that entails up until, well, I'll assume you know the rest of the story. And then finally, Mary of Bethany, as Stump reads her, is a story of the misery of being unwanted, being shamed, and being heartbroken. She brings out each of those elements that she sees in the character of Mary of Bethany. So she goes on to say that through their terrible suffering, these people are brought to a gloriousness or an excellence, a kind of complicated excellence that encompasses what she calls the desires of their heart within a deeper desire for God. So the idea is, you know, so if you take Abraham, his desire for his son, right? He just desires his son as to be the source of his progeny, right? Abraham wants to be a patriarch. That's his heart's desire, right? To have a vast number of descendants. You might not be able to relate to that, but that was a big deal for Abraham. That was what God had promised for him. That was his sort of his deepest earthly desire, was to be, stand at the pinnacle of this great, vast progeny, right? This people that God was going to establish. And now God's asking him, I want you to sacrifice Isaac, right? And that sounds like the loss of the thing that was the deepest heart's desire. In the end, God sends the angel, keeps Abraham from going through, right? He just wants Abraham to see that he was capable of obeying God. And now he now looks at Isaac in a different way, because his deepest desire is God, and he gets connected to that. Let me read a passage that I know I'm conscious I'm going rather quickly. So I typed out a passage from the text that I think helps you to see what she's thinking. So she says, when Abraham goes to sacrifice Isaac at God's command, he suffers because Isaac is his heart's desire. But he goes nonetheless, because his deepest heart's desire is God. At that point in his life, his desire for Isaac is encompassed within his desire for God. When Lazarus is resurrected, Mary of Bethany finds that what she could not have imagined in advance is in fact more her heart's desire than what she originally thought she had wanted. She goes on, after the resurrection of Lazarus, so Jesus resurrects Lazarus, Mary now loves Jesus in loving Lazarus, and she loves Lazarus in loving Jesus. What is new is not her love for Lazarus or for Jesus, but somehow the interconnection for her of these two loves. The interconnections of these loves is missing for her in the terrible time when Jesus does not come to heal Lazarus. In that time, Mary loses her belief that Jesus cares about her love for Lazarus. In effect, she thinks that the desires of her heart do not matter to Jesus. And so she believes that she has lost irrevocably the desires of her heart for Lazarus and for Jesus. That is why she sinks into broken heartbrokenness. When Lazarus is restored to her through the miracle Jesus does, Mary's love for Jesus becomes part of her love for Lazarus. Her heart is still set on Lazarus then, but it is set on Lazarus as now as a gift, as something given to her by a person on whom her heart is set in an even deeper way. So she, as she describes it elsewhere, she's saying her love for Lazarus now gets enfolded within her love for Jesus, because Jesus has given her back Lazarus, right? She went through this period of suffering. It was just a period of days in her case, right? But as the result, the outcome of that is she's gotten what she's wanted, union with her brother, her beloved brother, and with Jesus in a more profound way as a result of the very suffering that occurred. All right, that's a very quick summary of a big book, okay? That's kind of the heart of what she's up to in the book. There are limits to what she's proposing here. So first off, she acknowledges certain limits explicitly. She says she doesn't intend her account to apply. She intends it to apply only to adult humans of typical cognitive development. So it doesn't apply to children who never reach maturity, who suffer and then die, right? Never having reached adult maturity. It doesn't apply to the severely cognitively impaired, right? Whether from birth again or through later traumatic injury. All right. But she cites research. So with that limitation in mind, she's only intending to address sort of cognitively average adult human beings. She cites research about how traumatic stress, psychological research, about how traumatic stress leading to the point of desperation can be the catalyst for psychic integration in a person and new growth through a really traumatic process of healing. Okay. However, okay, and let's suppose that's so. Sometimes that happens for people. It actually leads to kind of new growth as a person as a result through a process of reflection on what happened at an earlier traumatic period of your life. However, it's also clear that some sorts of suffering in at least some sorts of people tends to diminish the sufferer. Leading to worse psychological health than they were in before they suffered, and having a decreased capacity for personal relationships. So sometimes deeply devout Christians have suffered horribly through some circumstance, and they report they want to love God, but they feel incapable of it. The capacity to reach out to God in love, which they had. To a degree, not perfectly, but to a significant degree prior to the trauma, they just become incapable of it. And God just seems utterly distant to them. And they're powerless over this. They don't want it, right? But it's there. And so it doesn't lead to the kind of, difficult but ultimately redemptive kind of healing in their life. In the cases of some kinds of psychological trauma, people are just shattered psychologically, just broken, right, as people, and therapists can't help them put the pieces back together, right? That happens sometimes to people in the cases of severe trauma. The difference between, whether that happens to you or some positive growth ultimately comes about, it's not something that's a function of your will. You decided. The one person just decided to grit it out, do what was necessary. The other person just gave up too quickly or something. No, it's largely beyond people's control. They don't, right? People naturally have varying degrees of resilience, right? The capacity to survive very difficult circumstances. So the picture she's painting doesn't seem to apply to those kinds of cases. That's my point. In the case of major natural disasters, it seems like we get indiscriminate suffering. Large masses of people suffer horribly, right? And so it doesn't seem tailored to the emotional or spiritual, moral needs of people, right? It's just everyone suffers across the board, regardless of where they were at in terms of their moral, spiritual development. Finally, people die at very different ages. Again, even if we're going to not pay attention for the moment and say, we'll treat as a separate issue to be thought about, children who die, right? Even if we're just focusing on people who do reach adult maturity, some people die pretty young. They die in their 20s or 30s, right? Other people live well into their 90s, sometimes past 100, right? And if you think about who dies at these different times, there again seems like there's an element of seeming randomness, because sometimes it's not true that only the good die young, as the song puts it, right? Sometimes wicked people die young, right? And you might say, it would have been better for them had they lived longer. They might have had more opportunity to turn it around. They weren't given that opportunity. They went down a bad path, and before they had an opportunity that many other people get over the period of decades, that's the end. In other cases, you have people who had lived very good lives, very devout, Godward lives, but maybe under the pressure of more and more suffering and seeing things happen to their children, everything, they kind of taper off. In purely spiritual terms, it might have been better for them had they been spared all that and just died younger, right? That the final stage of their life didn't go so well, not nearly as well. So again, the fact that people die at different ages doesn't seem to be effectively addressed by her proposal. So in sum, what I'm saying is, I think what the kind of thing she's talking about, it has application to some cases. It just doesn't seem like it applies across the board to all the kinds of cases, right? And so it's not a complete solution. All right, more quickly, because there's just a single idea here. In Marilyn Adams, she has had a book, Horrendous Evil and the Goodness of God. She's drawing on the 14th century mystic Julian of Norwich. I don't know how many of you have heard of Julian of Norwich. Really fascinating mystical writer who had a debilitating illness at the age of 30. Got a slide there for her book. It gets published in many editions. So she had this very debilitating illness as a fairly young woman at the age of 30, and she then had a series of 16 very vivid visions in a very short period of time of Christ's passion, right? The suffering Christ underwent, right? Of being tortured and crucified, right? And she talks about how these vivid visions that she had were just powerfully consoling to her. She saw her own, so she was suffering intensely when this was happening. And she identified her suffering, right, with Christ's suffering. And she in seeing that the connection between those two, she felt like it enabled her to draw closer to Jesus Christ, the incarnate God, the God-man, right, who also suffered, right? And so she felt like it was actually, her suffering, it was terrible, it was bad, but it was also a weirdly a point of connection, right? That you know, Jesus understands what I'm going through. He went through an intense kind of suffering of his own. All right, so Adams takes this suggestion and she says, of course, you know, Julian of Norwich, that happened in her earthly life. She had this consoling thing. Most people don't have anything like that. You might even theoretically say, yeah, Jesus died, he suffered on his passion, but it might not bring you consolation in the way it did her. It was this ecstatic set of visions that she had that profoundly affected her for the rest of her life. She survived the illness and it profoundly affected her. So Adams's suggestion is post-mortem, after death. So some people just die and they never have that. And so it seems like their suffering had no redemptive value for them. But it could be that God enables, after death, people to link their past earthly suffering to Christ's passion in just the way Julian of Norwich was speaking about, and that would render that suffering deeply meaningful to the person who is now united with Christ in heaven, right? So it's not just gratuitous, oh, that was horrible, it had no meaning, but thank goodness that's over. It's no. I can look back, that's part of my story, my narrative, that horrible suffering, and God enables me to link that to the passion of Christ where God suffered on our behalf, and that is a kind of consoling fact that there's this point of linkage between your experience and the experience of Christ. So that's Adams's idea. God could do something like that, even though it doesn't happen on the earthly life, but the earthly life is part of a longer stretch. Our narrative continues. If Christianity is true, right, we continue, right? And it's in that context that the meaning begins to be acquired. Well, a strength of this idea is it seems to complement Stump's proposal. It's consistent with Stump's proposal. Sorry, I should be checking the time here. What time did we start, Chris? 6:30, right? Okay, I got to... Okay, 6:35. All right. But it also it shores up weaknesses in Stump's theodicy because, but not everyone in this life, of course, is drawn closer to God through suffering. And the idea is if that can happen after death, okay, then that's another potential avenue. But some potential problems. You might say, well, presumably, this kind of extreme suffering that some people undergo is optional as a path to greater intimacy with Christ. Because we don't want to say people who undergo the worst kind of suffering get to have a closer relationship with God in Christ than people who never had that kind of suffering. Because if we thought that was true, then we ought to seek it out, right? Maybe even help our friends to find it, right? That, you know, no, and she doesn't want to say that, right? So it's just a way towards intimacy with Christ, but it's not the only way, right? Because all of the redeemed in heaven are going to experience deep intimacy with God in Christ. But then it might seem unnecessary, right? If it's just one way, but then why have that way since it's such an intrinsically bad way to begin with? And then some people say, well, you know, if it's optional, it seems unfair. Why did I have to undergo the horrendous evil route to ultimately experiencing redemption? Some people lived quiet lives, right, of, you know, beautiful holiness, but, you know, nothing traumatic. they got to see, you know, they had children and they got to see their children grow up and flourish. It seems unfair, right? You might worry. So what she's proposing doesn't really seem to address that. So I want to close by talking about that and connecting that to the idea of the communion of saints. Because so far we've been talking in very individualistic terms, right? I undergo suffering. Job underwent suffering, right? The character Job in the biblical story, right? Mary of Bethany. These are individuals. And what is God doing in their relationship with, their individual relationship with God, right? But Christianity teaches a communal state post, you know, in heaven, where we together enjoy intimacy with God. It's an intensely communal experience in a way that in our highly individualistic Western culture, we don't usually think about, right? This kind of intense community. So the first thing is I want to say is, you know, is there a fundamental problem of unfairness? Well, provided God can bring great good out of even horrendous kind of suffering, maybe there's a goodness to the fact that we play different roles in the drama, right? When we're not thinking about suffering, we tend to think it's a good thing that we don't all live, that we're not carbon copies of each other, all living the same kind of lives, right? But maybe the fact that we have very different paths with respect to suffering can be a good thing too, because if we can all somehow eventually benefit from the very different kinds of experiences that other people have had and bring into that communion of saints. You know, it may be that certain people that suffer heroically, right, enjoy a kind of more blessed state. That's another kind of theme that's part of the Christian teaching that we're a little bit embarrassed about, right? Because we're also, as Americans, we're very egalitarian. Right? Nobody's better than anyone else, right? And certainly we're all co-equal children of God, right? But there's also this idea of some people have a more intense, everyone's happy in heaven. Everyone experiences bliss. And yet some people have a kind of more exalted status. They drew closer to God in their earthly life, and that's in some way reflected in heaven itself. It's in the Bible. I don't have time to go through passages, but it's been part of the Christian tradition to teach this. But, you know, if that were true on earth, of course, we'd be really envious. It's like, oh, well, but there is no sin in heaven. So there's no sin of envy. So you're not feeling envious. You're just extremely, you know, joyful in union with God. And you can even see someone else has even this more intense union, you know, joyful union with God. And you can be glad of that fact. You're not envious of that. Furthermore, this idea of communion of saints, a lot of thinkers, including Aquinas, suggested that we get this kind of supernatural ability to be aware of each other and each other's thoughts that we don't have right now. It's part of our earthly life. So if we were all in heaven together, we'd be kind of more deeply aware of what's going on in the minds of one another. We'd be able to communicate. We'd be able to understand each other's experiences, right? We somehow have, you know, right? We have the cognitive limitations. We can't take all that in any given moment. But the suggestion is that's part of this glorious resurrected body and capacity. We're going to have this transformed cognitive understanding, right? And so if that's true, and if this guy has suffered horrendously and has ultimately come to experience and understand the mercy of God through that experience, I can learn from his experience. And he can learn from my very different kind of experience. We can learn from her experience. And so the fact that we have these very different paths there, it's as if we're seeing different facets of the divine mercy and love and goodness by the fact that we've had different, very different experiences of it, and it's impacted us differently. And that's a good thing. What results is a richer shared understanding of God than what we would have otherwise. So Aquinas says in the Summa Theologica, this is shorthand for referring to Aquinas' masterwork, the Summa Theologiae, he says we will collectively be, right? We're called image bearers of God, each of us as individuals. We bear the divine image, right? He said the word icon is just image-bearing word. We will collectively be more perfect icons of God who is a Trinity. So there's a sense in which any individual human cannot, Aquinas suggests, cannot be a perfect image bearer of God, because God's a three in one. He's a Trinity of persons within one being. Well, so collectively, we can have that plurality within oneness among ourselves. None of us has that individually. Finally, when you think about the question of fairness, when it comes to suffering, just think for a moment about the sweep of human history that crosses generations, that have such profoundly different experiences of the world, profoundly different cultures around the world, and whole epochs. Human beings in the Bronze Age. There will be human beings in the Bronze Age in heaven. There will be human beings in our present technological age. Maybe there will be human beings 500 years from now in an even more profoundly transformed human. Who knows, right? In other words, just think about the differences, right? When you start to think about that, you know, the idea of fairness, to making sure that everyone sort of experiences things the same way, it seems to be kind of pointless. It kind of falls away. There's just an incredible richness in what we will communally experience. And the same is true, I suggest, with respect to suffering. That was a lot. I'll leave you with this the closing stanza from Dante's Divine Comedy. Thank you for your attention. Now we have some time for some questions.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.